The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
AM 1220 KDOW is proud to present Kim McNicholas on Innovation, spotlighting successful entrepreneurs, innovators, investors, and industry experts. Their stories and insights can help you become better informed, better educated, and a better investor. Your host is Emmy Award-winning anchor, reporter, and writer Kim McNicholas. Kim has been a journalist at Forbes magazine, a Fox News Channel contributor, vetted more than 3,000 startups, and has been a mentor for entrepreneurs around the globe. Now, Kim McNicholas on Innovation.
Welcome back to the show. It is time for our The Edge series, featuring companies that are impacting the enterprise, those companies that have the potential to save your business time and money. Today, we are featuring Mark Wiener, Versa Network's Chief Marketing Officer. It's great to have you in studio today.
Thank you very much.
I know you'd rather be outside because it's beautiful out there. The weather is just gorgeous.
Carpe diem.
So you've got a lot of experience, a ton of experience, over 20 years of leadership and market creation experience in the networking, security, cloud, and data center sectors. And I want to get into a little bit, though, before we get into your career per se, I mentioned that you're working right now with Versa Networks. Tell us a little bit more about Versa Networks and what you're doing.
Absolutely. So Versa,
in layman's terms, you got to keep in mind we're talking to the mainstream here, so they may not be into that, you know, into the trenches with all of the IT folks.
And I will avoid any acronyms. I'm told is the right thing to do.
Thank you. I'll definitely appreciate that.
So Versa, we are a 4-year-old, you know, later stage startup, really working on changing what's called the wide area network, or how companies connect their headquarters to all their users and all their offices around the country or around the world. And that's really changing as more and more people and companies are looking at software and resources in the cloud and all over, not just going back to their company headquarters.
So really, how do you fit in there? Can you give us an example of what you provide? Do you have a customer you can experience that you can share?
Certainly. So we help, for example, both enterprises as well as the data carriers or phone companies that serve them as well.
Okay.
And great example, we have one of our big customers is one of the top service providers or carriers in all of North America. And they use our software along with our partner's hardware, and they're using it to connect companies all over the country and all over the world so they can very quickly, you know, make their connections, go to the cloud, do things a lot faster, a lot safer, and a lot less expensive.
And your company has managed to raise, check this out, they have managed to raise and secure $43.35 million in two rounds from three investors.
Three very strong investors.
Sequoia, Mayfield, and also Verizon Ventures.
Correct.
How is it that this company has been able to convince just three investors? Because normally when I talk to startups, it usually takes quite a bit of a, you know, pounding of pavement down Sand Hill Road in order to get maybe 20 of them to come up with even $5 million. You have three who've put in $43 million.
Correct, including the first round was over $14 million from a single investor.
You're kidding.
It has to do with our founders. Actually, brothers, Kumar and Apurva Mehta, are brothers. They were brought in to Juniper Networks.
I was going to say Juniper Networks.
Yep. Years ago, they were brought in by the company to build what today is their flagship product line. They built it from scratch. It's called the MX series. Big routers. They built it from scratch. And that is, you know, a large percentage of their product revenue today. The brothers built it from scratch, made it a multi-billion-dollar over 10 years business for Juniper.
Mm-hmm.
And they had innovation. They had ideas. Pretty innovative. How do we take in software what has been done forever in hardware so companies can really do things, make their networks faster, access the cloud, be secure, and all that really fast, not traditional old school hardware?
I know there are a lot of people at home that are still scratching their heads. $43 million. What do you do with $43 million?
You build a great platform like we have that is addressing a market opportunity that today is over $6 billion in market opportunity in 2020, says analyst firm IDC. Great market. Basically, how do you take the internet and use it to connect all parts of your business along with today the older school network types? How to use the internet? That's going to be a $6 billion market. And the brothers and the whole engineering team we built out using that money built an amazing platform that can do just what 2, 3, 4 independent companies have been able to do historically.
So can you just paint the picture a little bit more in layman's terms so that people at home who maybe don't have a business or maybe have a smaller business and are saying,
sure,
well, is this something that we need? We've never heard of something like this. It's a little bit gorky, you have to admit. And
yes,
so obviously, I think they get the point that a lot of people are interested in because a lot of money is going into it from some of the biggest firms in Silicon Valley. So what was missing in this space that you've been able to come in and fill?
You bet. So the market,
why?
You bet. So the market itself is fairly new. It's maybe 2 years or so old. The wide area market's been around for 30 plus years.
It's been around
a long time. That's WAN, the WAN. But using the internet as an integrated part of the WAN, not going to the internet to look at a site like Yahoo or Google or whichever, but using the internet as a circuit, as a connection, as a pipe to get to and go places versus expensive old private networks, that concept is very new. And doing that real smart, the market, they call it software-defined WAN, or a WAN that is being told what to do by software, not by old school methods.
So meaning say, hardware.
Yep, meaning hardware. Yep, meaning just hardware. I'll give you the example. We're in 7-Eleven, and they obviously have Wi-Fi. So, hey, I'm looking to search something. I need to go out and check my website or my email. I'm a customer. Today, I have to go over the same expensive old WAN that the company is using to report all of its cash register receipts or all of its accounting.
No.
So you're paying tons of money. Ooh, I'm looking at video and YouTube. You're burning all the bandwidth. And 7-Eleven has to pay more and more money. I'm using 7-Eleven just as a random example.
No, but just starting to get it. Okay.
So imagine if, hey, you can use an inexpensive cable connection, a cable like you and I have at home, simple cable connection for all the users, all the visitors, just to go out and check and see things. Very inexpensive. But I'm going to keep that expensive, private, safe, safe carrier connection just for my cash register receipts, maybe my back-end accounting as I true up at the end of the day.
Okay.
And because I have the business stuff, goes over the expensive, private, safe, but older network, and all the internet traffic and everything else goes over the inexpensive broadband connection. And maybe even going forward, 7-Eleven or whomever uses another application up on the cloud. Why not use an internet connection to go to something that's in the internet anyway? Why use my expensive old connection that I'm using, let's say, for my business apps that has to go back out to the internet anyway? So send traffic to where it is needs to go, and also use the right pipe and the right price depending on what you're doing. That's never been done. It was old school network, pay more if you need more, and that's it. That's what's changing, and we're really hitting it different, not going at it all with hardware, but putting all those features into super smart software that you can scale up and down real easy. No one's done that via software, and no one's done it collecting all those things.
But how is it more secure than it is on hardware?
So in the past, what you've had to do, and even there's obviously a couple other vendors in this space. We're not the only vendor.
I would think software would be a lot easier to hack.
Actually, in some ways, no. Historically, you've had to put multiple boxes in. I've got something called a firewall, like you and I have at home with our cable modems.
Yeah.
I got a firewall. We've been able to put all that into software. I call it, we built a Lego set. We built a whole bunch of individual pieces, and you can build neat things with it. We have software pieces you can put right on the network piece, so the whole thing's integrated. Your network has built-in security via software, and it can actually be a lot more secure because all the smarts and most of these hardware bits are from software anyway. Imagine if you took the hardware off, you can glue it together all in software and then stick it on inexpensive hardware.
So what is the greatest resistance? You're the CMO, so you're on the front lines. You're out there with the customers all the time.
Last night for dinner, yes.
Were you treating them out to a good dinner?
Yes, I was.
Why not the World Series that the big Cubs win? That would have been a nice one. That's... bring out those customers, right?
And they were a Midwest customer. I'll stop there.
So what resistance do you face from some of these potential customers when you're out there? What are their biggest questions? What are their greatest doubts?
Sure. I think a lot of them believe and see the market, but they're how do I really put it into motion? Mm-hmm. I've done things historically for a long time using traditional boxes, traditional networks. That to them they have to understand a little bit. And I think they need to really see what can be done in software. How can I get a cheap Intel box, a commodity box in the branch office, or a commodity server in my data center? And then I'm gluing this great software. Does it really perform like hardware does? How easy is it to configure and turn on? And hey, you've made all these features. You made five products into one. Does it really work like that? And how do they all work together? Is it complex? And we show them the screens and go, wow, click, click. In three clicks, I can configure this. I can FedEx a box to my 100 remote sites, and an admin can plug it in with two cables, and the box calls home and it's running in 3 minutes. You show them that live in a demo, then they go, all right, let's talk more. Let's go to the whiteboard. They need to see it to believe it.
Yeah, and that's hard to get in the doors when you're making those phone calls. How quickly, how many, what is the percentage of phone, you know, cold calls that you actually get a return on?
It's actually pretty darn high. Again, given the relations of our founders and our sales team, we knew initially some of these very big data carriers. We got in with them. And now as we go talk to customers, we say, look, X, Y, and Z are using this product and scaling it out to their own hundreds and thousands of customers. They go, okay, we'll take an appointment.
That's exciting. Well, coming up next right here on Kim McNicholas on Innovation and the Edge series. More with Versa CMO Mark Wiener, who has a hobby fit for a Bay Area executive so close to the Napa Valley. It's winemaking. We'll find out more about that coming up next, so stay with us.
Now, back to Kim McNicholas on Innovation.
Welcome back to the show and back to our The Edge series, where we feature companies that are impacting the enterprise, those companies that have the potential to save your business time and money. And today, we are featuring Mark Wiener. He is the CMO of Versa Networks, and it's great to have you in studio today, Mark.
Thank you, Kim.
And we talked in the last hour all about your experience, over 20 years of leadership and market creation experience, networking, security, cloud, and data center sectors, and we talked about Versa Networks. And I'm just curious, with all of this experience in business, I mean, there must have been there must be a lot of stress, a lot of hours put into the boardroom. What do you do to balance that out? Make wine.
I try.
You try to make wine. How long have you been doing this?
16 years.
Oh, you're kidding.
No.
What got you interested in doing that? I mean, there's so many hobbies. So many Silicon Valley executives, they end up kiteboarding, like Bill Tai, who used to be with Charles River Network, Charles River Ventures. And there are people that surf or whatever, but you make wine.
I do. I had an old colleague many years ago at one of my former startups, and he did it, and we did wine tasting on Fridays. He brought in his own bottle, said, how do you do that? I want to learn.
Really? Do you make better wine now than he does?
We both make drinkable stuff.
It's simply drinkable. What would you compare your wine to? What brand? Are you at the level of, you know, Roche or Prager Port? What kind of wines do you have?
Well, I've made mainly Pinots over the years.
Oh, I do. Pinot Noir.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, I love Pinot Noir.
It's a lot of fun. There's a lot of great folks around here making Pinot. I was lucky enough. I interned at Testarossa for a few years, and I learned a few things.
While you were working full-time?
Mm-hmm.
Really? So what did that internship consist of? What did that look like?
Oh, just helping out during the harvest days, helping with the fruit coming in, helping get it crushed and done, cleaning the equipment, helping it get started in the barrel. It was a lot of fun.
So here you were, a Silicon Valley executive in the boardroom, business suit, right? In the fields.
In the fields.
As an intern.
Mm-hmm, in the fields and in the crush room. And
you had to have set that little ego aside to go there into the trenches.
Oh, I was learning every harvest and every day.
And you were there at the very beginning. I don't know if anyone remembers Crush Pad.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I thought I'd do a little startup in the wine business. And yeah, I ran a little winery that was great. We sold up and down the state for about 5 years.
Yeah, talk a little bit about that.
That was fun. It was a little incubator for winery startups.
Right. So you were one of the founders.
I was one of the founding customers.
You were one of the founding customers. Were you also an investor in it or simply a customer?
Simply a customer.
Okay. Yeah, because CrushPad did end up going under. When was that?
It went under, I think, in 2011. Yeah. 2011 or 2012.
A little bit ago. Why did that not succeed? I'm curious, because I would think a wine incubator would be the ultimate for the Valley.
You know, it's hard. I think they every time they got extra capital, they wanted to grow. They wanted to keep scaling it out. They added a lot of people. They had a ton of services. But I think they didn't perhaps manage as well as many small businesses don't. Managing as you grow out, and how do you move toward, you know, breaking even as opposed to continuing to scale as you get more money and then keep needing more money?
Isn't that a motto here in Silicon Valley, like scale fast, fail fast?
I think it's test your idea and innovation fast. If it doesn't work, fail fast. But I think there needs to be a little bit of cash flow and investment management in there, cash management in there as well.
There needs to be a balance.
Yes, there does. You can innovate fast, and if the market doesn't take it, agreed. Fail fast, get out, do something different. It's a rite of passage. But if you have a great idea the market wants, you still have to carefully manage your resources and your scaling.
You know, I always think that a really good test is for whether you're ready to scale is if you're making money and you can actually scale by reinvesting revenue.
Correct. Now, I might say in a lot of companies that may be a little bit later stage, that may not be your first or second round of funding, depending what your development takes. But certainly you at least have to accurately forecast what is the demand, what's the best way to get it, and at least forecast how you get there and then reinvest, as opposed to simply scale out. I think you at least need to get set up for that.
So where are you at in your wine business on the side, and how do you plan to scale?
One of the other bits, but that's maybe not for a venture funded or your own personal business, is what size do you want to be at?
Mm-hmm.
I make enough to give to friends, colleagues, family, and manage to do that at the right level. You need to know when is enough and when is too much. Because if you make too much, you got to figure out where you store it. Otherwise known
true.
In the industry as inventory management. I'll call it where you put stuff at home.
Do you have a basement?
I've got a little in-house, a little bit out of house too.
So how do you go about this? What do you have? What are some of the things you were talking about before we came into this segment? A heating blanket. You have all of the toys.
Yeah, I got all the crusher, the press, the nice French barrels, the cellar. It's little home outfit I learned from what the real guys do.
All in your backyard,
mm-hmm.
In a little shed.
Mm-hmm.
And your idea of a shed looks like what? It's probably pretty nice, isn't it?
It's a cute little shed. It's a cute little shed. It's
How
tight.
How big are we talking?
It's not that big. It's maybe 8x12.
Okay. Now that's not too bad, actually.
Yeah.
Kind of tight quarters. So when are you harvesting now? Like the folks in Napa Valley?
Oh, harvest is done. This was a great year. Pretty much everyone's harvest was done
by... Wait, we're in November, aren't we?
Some years you can even get late grapes like Cabernet now. I've had Cab as late as like today. This year we got the grapes in by mid-September.
Isn't there... I've heard that the grapes are in such high demand in Napa Valley that it's hard to get your hands on the good grapes. What's your secret to success there?
Oh, and I've only done one or two Napas. I typically do either Monterey or Sonoma area.
Okay.
Pinot,
Napa's,
more available? Yeah, Napa's a little more Cab and Chardonnay than it is Pinot, but Napa's crazy. You can pay tens of thousands of dollars a ton for the fancy, fancy cult name cabs these days. It's crazy.
That's amazing. Well, thank you so much, Mark, for joining us right here on Kim McNicholas on Innovation and Art the Edge series. We look forward to tasting that wine sometime soon. We've enjoyed your time here, your wealth of knowledge. And as I said, that wine, I'd better get a taste of. Well, coming up next in our second hour, why go out and buy a separate smartwatch when you could just make your own? Just as smart. Coming up at the top of the hour, the company that is raising the IQ of the average watch with the switch of your wristband. So stay with us.
Now, back to Kim McNicholas on Innovation.
Welcome back to the show. Really excited to have all the way in from Paris. From Paris, we have Hussein Ahmed. He is a founder of MainTool and CEO of MainTool. MainTool has developed the world's first leather smart straps for classic watches that give your traditional timepiece the same features and connectivity as today's best wearables. Now, you're familiar with the smartwatch. I'm sure so many of you probably have an Apple Watch. But I've always wondered, with so many people out there with these high-end watches that they've collected over time, you don't wear two watches. And so here's a company that has come up with a solution, and it is by simply changing the straps and putting the smartness simply into the straps that can connect to anyone's watch.
That's right, Kim. Yep. So, I mean, our vision at MainTool is basically to seamlessly embed technology into daily accessories that are already a part of people's
right.
daily lives. So, I mean, you know, we believe that in order for technology to be massively adopted, it needs to be something that just blends into your life and, you know, seamlessly integrates. So when smartwatches first came out, right, they sort of begged the question, well, first of all, are they really watches? You know, the Apple Watch probably lasts about 24 hours, maybe 48 hours maximum
if
in
that.
Battery life. But after that, it's basically just this black iPod Nano screen that's sitting on your wrist that doesn't actually give you the time, right? So that's the question, right? Is it really a watch? And the other question...
Well, it does give you the time.
Yes, but when it's out of battery, it's just this black iPod Nano screen, right, that's,
okay,
that's sitting on your
right.
wrist. And so the other question was, well, are all these smartwatches going to replace the 1.3 billion wristwatches that people are already wearing, that are already on people's wrists? And so, I mean, we started thinking of the problem another way, right? What if they don't have to? What if we could add the same connectivity, the same features that all these great smart bands have, like a Fitbit and a Jawbone, to any regular wristwatch without compromising on the design, on the brand? You know, there's so much more to a watch than something that just tells the time.
Right.
Right. It's about, you know, it's about the brand. It's about the design. It's about how it makes you feel. There's a sentimental value associated to each timepiece. Right. So when we looked at this problem, which was basically how to make any watch smart, we started thinking, well, what's in common with every timepiece? Right. What does every single watch have in common? And, you know, we figured that it wasn't the dial, because that's actually the most unique part, right? You know, some have, they all have different kinds of movements, you know, some are automatic, you know. And so, but every watch has a strap. So what if we were able to put all the same electronics, all the same sensors that do activity tracking, that notify through vibration, that a Fitbit and a Jawbone have inside a regular wristwatch strap, such that, you know, if I happen to be wearing one on my wrist right now with this Tissot watch face, you shouldn't be able to notice. So actually, as a matter of fact, I don't know if you did, because I am wearing one right now.
Yeah, let me see
this
that.
This is the world's first leather smart strap for classic watches that you
that's
can wear
really
to
a nice
any
leather,
time.
Too. Oh, my goodness. That's
yes.
a really nice leather.
So we're actually working with four watch strap producers that are experts in basically making leather straps for big watch brands. And this is the first time they're integrating electronics inside a leather watch band. It's a completely new process for them. It's all our, the way you construct a regular watch strap compared to ours is completely different. So actually we've been the ones who've invented all of that. And that's all of our IP and our proprietary knowledge that we've sort of given them and shown them how to do it in partnership. And now we're working with these guys that know leather, they know you know, the watch industry, and so we're able to produce things that look basically like that. I have a couple more samples here as well for you to show.
And so I'm just noticing on this one in particular that it's pretty rigid. Are most men's watches pretty rigid? And because it's rigid, are the sensors easily destructible?
So actually, though, all of the electronics is in the part that's concealed underneath the watch face. On the sides, you just have these the batteries, and there's a push button that's actually hidden here that you can feel.
Oh, I feel it.
Yeah, so the button can be used to trigger an emergency alert if you hold
it. Oh, it buzzes. Oh, wow.
Yeah, exactly. So it will vibrate. You can choose, customize the different vibration patterns through the app. So if you get a phone call, if you get a text, if you get an email, if you've forgotten to put your phone on silent in a meeting, which happens a lot, you can just reject a phone call by tapping the button. And the other cool feature with the button is especially the emergency alert. So you put in a contact in your mobile phone in the app.
Oh, you're kidding.
And when you hold the button on the strap for 4 seconds, your phone will send a text to this contact saying, like, help or whatever, with your GPS location.
So that's interesting, because last year, and how I met you was through the Extreme Tech Challenge,
that's
which
right.
is the world's largest startup competition, which over the past 2 years has had more than 3,000 startups apply, another 1,000 this year as well. But you were in the top 25 in last year's group. And also alongside you was a company called Revelar, which has a separate emergency alert button that's connected to an app. So you can clip it on to your bra strap, to your belt, whatever it is, press the button, and through the app, geolocation, it shows exactly where you're at and to tell your family to send emergency services straight. So hate to say that this could ultimately replace that, and it's already integrated into your watch.
Well, I mean, it's an alternative. Yeah, the idea is that, you know, we're trying to add tech to things that people already have, so there's not this massive adoption problem that's currently occurring. You know, we saw a bunch of wearables. Latest earnings reports, and people are ditching their wearable because the trade-off of functionality versus design isn't there anymore, right? So if the use cases aren't good enough and it's already something that people aren't going to wear in the first place, right, then they're just going to stop wearing it. Well, as here, the importance of functionality versus design, you know, it's something that people are already wearing. People are already wearing their watch, right? So they are going to use the features because it's there, and if this, you know, is ever out of battery, at least you're still wearing your classic timepiece that gives you the time. Right. So, I mean, that's what we are trying to do. We're trying to massively adopt without changing people's habits.
And so what's really interesting is that if there are upgrades in software or whatever, they don't have to replace the entire timepiece. They only have to replace the wristband.
Yeah, that's right.
And that's pretty exciting.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, really what you are buying and what you love is the timepiece itself. And you're willing to spend hundreds and thousands of dollars on that ultimate timepiece.
Yeah. And our approach has actually been to go and see the watchmakers, the people who are, you know, the masters behind building these dials and these movements and have been around for hundreds of years. And basically saying, well, here's a solution, right, on a silver platter to make any of your watches smart. Right. Now, we've seen a lot of a large decrease, actually, in the sales of Swiss watches. It was the first time in the last quarter of last year that there were more smartwatches sold than Swiss watches combined. There were actually 8.1 million smartwatches sold versus 7.9 million Swiss watches, which is just crazy to think about. Right. And if you had I don't know if you watched the last keynote, Apple's last keynote. So there was a slide in Tim Cook's speech that showed at the back the basically the biggest watch brands by sales, so by dollar sales. And Apple was number two under Rolex. So you basically had, right, Rolex and then Apple. And then everything else, like that you can think of, you know, Citizen, Longines, Tissot, Casio, like literally every single other brand underneath, which is just crazy to think about, right? So, and I mean, I was reading an article by this guy named John Beggs, who's basically TechCrunch's biggest watch fan, and his article sort of started out by showing this slide and saying, well, I think a few people in Switzerland must have choked on their Oyster Saint-Jacques when they saw Tim Cook's keynote. And so we're basically saying, well, you know, you don't have to worry about trying to add technology anymore. You don't have to change the industrial processes of your dials. You know, you don't have to, because embedding electronics isn't their core business. And they know that, you know, their core business is the mechanics. And so we're just basically giving them a plug and play solution that they can offer with new watch models, new lines, or their existing lines, right? People change when we started with leather, actually, because people change their leather strap every year, right? Mm-hmm. So usually leather wears out in a year. So you so our idea is if you're coming to the store, right, you're going to produce both, you know, you're going to be able to choose between a regular strap and leather strap. You won't know which one it is.
We'll have more with Hussein coming up in just a moment on how he's helping to raise the IQ of your watch.
Now, back to Kim McNicholas on Innovation.
Welcome back to the show. We have Hussein Ahmed. He is the founder and CEO of a company called Main Tool, and Main Tool has developed the world's first leather smart straps for classic watches that give your traditional timepiece the same features and connectivity as today's best wearables, such as the Apple smartwatch. Basically, raising the IQ of your wristband is basically what you're doing.
Yep, that's right.
And you came in all the way from Paris. What have you been doing here in Silicon Valley? Looking for investors?
So a bunch of different things, actually. Fundraising and biz dev, definitely. We've bootstrapped a lot since we started. I mean, we started out in 2014. We've gone through 7 full prototype iterations with our lead engineers are a bunch of early employees from WeThings, from other wearable companies, like have built over 24 connected devices each. This is the hardest one they've built ever. And we've bootstrapped a lot. We've only had a bunch of angel investors, actually probably in the equivalent of dollars, having raised a total of $620,000.
Oh, that's it?
Yeah. We've bootstrapped a lot, like I was saying. Like, I mean, for example, when we spent like 3 months fixing flexible connector issues that companies that had raised over like $10 million were having issues with their samples. And in order to solve this problem, we ended up, for example, building our own in-house test bench. So we 3D printed parts and we programmed them to do all kinds of movements on our bands, like shear stress, torsion over like thousands of cycles, made a lot of noise in the office.
Oh, I bet that was fun. That's probably the fun part of the job.
Yeah. And that's how we ended up getting that part right, for example. So it's been a long journey. It's been a lot of bootstrapping. We're now finally ready for mass production, getting set up with all our industrial processes, setup, etc. So we're looking to raise a larger round of financing.
So you're actually going into a Series A now.
That's right. Yeah. We're looking to raise a Series A and also a bunch of most innovative wearable companies, also watch brands that have started doing wearables are based here in the U.S., in New York and San Francisco. You might have heard of Fossil and Movado.
Heard of Fossil.
No, but they're smartwatch initiatives, right? Uh-huh. So Fossil bought Misfit for $260 million last year. Movado just released a whole bunch of smartwatches with HP. So they're some of the earlier players in the watch industry. Tag Heuer and Frédéric Constant from Switzerland were the first to release smartwatches. Tag Heuer released the first Android Wear Swiss watch last year. You may want to have a guess on how many they sold, because that's the big question. Like, they didn't expect to. It was really crazy. They sold 100,000 of the Tag Heuer Connect and it's priced at $1,500.
Oh, you're kidding.
Yes. So they made $150 million in revenue, like just like that, on an Android Wear. So this is like a screen, right? The same as a Samsung Gear, except that it's in the shape of a Tag Heuer watch face, and it has the Tag brand on it.
You're kidding. 100,000 of those at $1,500 a piece.
That's right. And their whole marketing pitch was also that sort of if you don't like it or it gets deprecated after, I think, 5 years, you can trade it in for a classic mechanical Tag Heuer high-end watch. So it was a really interesting approach. So we've definitely seen a lot of these Swiss players trying to get into this industry. They had partnered with Intel and Google. Movado partnered with HP. A bunch of companies are partnering with different tech firms, because that's, like I was saying, electronics is not their core business. Mm-hmm. Software isn't their core business. And so we're giving them an additional thing to add to all their lines, basically, all their existing lines for all their existing customers, and obviously for new models if they want to.
So why do you need to raise money, per se? Because, for example, there is a company called Raw Medical, which I've been traveling the country with, reporting and, you know, on their release of this brand new laser. They were able to create a laser that unclogs arteries. They started this company 15 years ago, and they have not taken on any venture capital. They used their own revenue. They reinvested their own revenue. They created partners, reinvested their own revenue, and were able to create this big product. Why couldn't you do the same?
Right. And I mean, that's a really good question. So because our approach is B2B, purely, some of these discussions are taking long. So we have two or three medium brands that should close before the end of the year. We're in conversation with all of the big groups. But like on the Swiss watch industry side, people are just waking up, right? So these discussions are going to take some time. So the first thing is that, you know, as a startup, we don't have time. We're sort of done with the idea of, you know, always having like a couple months runway and then having to raise another bridge round and then having to do that. So we're at a stage where we really want to scale up our R&D team. A lot of companies have approached us to do other custom devs. So we've actually been approached by a really big car company recently that want us to make the first keyless solution for a connected car, because the people who drive that kind of car are never going to wear an Apple Watch. And so some people might be able to guess which company it is. Uh-huh. And so we've been approached by a bunch of people to do that kind of stuff. We really want to scale up our R&D team. We see ourselves as an IoT embedded sensor company, and we need to expand our business efforts. So that's why we're really raising money at this point in time.
What's your raise, can I ask?
So we're looking to raise between $3 and $5 million.
Oh, that's not that much. Oh, that's nothing. Okay. I thought you were looking. I mean, we just had a company in here that just raised $43 million with Sequoia, Mayfield, and Verizon Ventures, three huge firms. It only took them three venture firms to actually raise $43 million for Versa Networks.
Yeah, no, obviously, it's relatively speaking.
But you do, you are making some money. You are bringing in, for example, with those partnerships, the one you were talking about with the unnamed car company, that you have some special projects with, that they are generating some revenue for you.
Yeah, I mean, we are mainly pre-revenue at this stage. We do have a lot of intents. We do have a lot of traction. So our main source of funding at the moment is from strategic angel investors through basically bridge money. So for example, the two biggest supermarket chains in France, different from the families that founded them, just recently invested in us, actually after they saw us on a radio show. And we also got backing from one of our early investors is the founder of the Neo robot. I don't know if you know the little humanoid robot Neo. So the company Aldebaran got acquired by SoftBank for $100 million last year.
Wow.
So their founder, who's a French guy called Bruno, is one of our early investors. And a bunch of other people basically have been supporting us in these early stages.
I've been covering startups since 1997. I've also been running that Extreme Tech Challenge with Richard Branson. And I mean, my greatest suggestion to every single company is to figure out at least one stream of revenue immediately. Find one strategic partner, whether it's that car company, and focus on them just a little bit. Bring in focus a 30 of your effort on that one company, at least generate some revenue to show that you can, and you can have one successful partnership. Because I think that that's going to set you apart from every other company out there that is just going out there and saying, oh yeah, we're going to make money down the road. We're going to have strategic partnerships down the road. Here's one solid one that they're going to go out there and they're going to be your biggest fans.
Yeah. I mean, that's definitely something we're focusing on right now is biz dev and fundraising, basically.
Mm-hmm.
So my partner, he's full time, and he was actually in Geneva yesterday meeting with the people at the Richemont Group. I was at the different brands. I was at IWC 2 weeks ago. I was at Piaget 3 weeks ago, and we've been talking, trying to put talking with these guys. A lot of them, it's very early in the process for them. It was a very new product. We're the first guys to really do this, and so we're the first to try and penetrate this watch industry, the Swiss watch industry. There are a few people that have started to do things, but it's still, they're really early in the process. So we're hoping to basically be able to raise money so that we can scale up our team and go, and because we can't spread our resources then either, on BD and on custom dev, et cetera.
And now really quickly, because we're running out of time here, but you were mentioning that there's some new great functionality that you're expecting with this watch.
Yeah, so we're excited to be implementing hands-free navigation. So basically, instead of having to walk around keep staring at the screen on your phone, now you're guided through vibration. So basically, you're walking in the street, or you come to an intersection, you just have to double tap on your watch face, quite literally, because it uses the accelerometer, and it will vibrate once to tell you to go left, twice that you're going the right way, and three times tell you you're going right. And eventually, we're also going to be implementing these new haptic vibration motors that we found that we're really excited about. It's basically this kind of tic-tac weight where that you feel the shift in addition to the vibration. So you actually feel the direction of the vibration. So you're feeling it take you slightly to the left and slightly to the right in addition to feeling a vibration. So that's one of the cool features we're excited to be announcing.
That's really exciting. And so when can people, now that people are listening to this, then when can I raise the IQ of my watch?
So we're hoping actually to be going to mass production towards the last quarter of, the end of the first quarter of next year.
Okay.
And so we're basically gearing up right now. We have our manufacturer set. We have our industrial processes set up. We've been through the certifications, et cetera. So we're pretty much set on a production and hoping to start it and start preparing it right now and hopefully start it in the end of the first quarter of next year.
So it's not just about partnering with the major watch brands that are out there, but also these wristbands could potentially be sold independently to fit a variety of watches at possibly Nordstrom and Saks Fifth Avenue and Macy's and all of the above, even REI.
Yeah. I mean, that is definitely an option. We're open to partnering with both watchmakers and retailers. The only thing is we do want to white label at this point in time, mm-hmm. because we're not a marketing company. We're an engineering company. We're not looking to build our own brand at this point in time. We may for a future product, but at this point in time, we want to white label, and our vision of seamlessly integrating technology on the product level, we want it to be reflected on the brand level. So consumers, you know, if they're going to, they want to see this with the watch that they're already wearing, they want it to be branded with the company that's already right. built their watch. So that's our vision of doing it. It's completely seamlessly. It's to create a complete seamless experience for our consumers.
So where can people find out more to let them know who you're partnering with, whether their watch is going to have this technology or sensors integrated into them, and when they can potentially get this in their hands?
So, like, besides on your show?
Yes. We'll definitely have you back. So if everybody continues to tune in, we'll definitely have you back on the show.
So, I mean, they can, so to go to our website, it's maintool.me. So just maintool, maintool.me, maintool.me. And we have a blog, so blog.maintool.me, where we post all our updates.
Thank you so much, Hussein, for coming in all the way from Paris to join us here on the show today.
Bonsoir.
Well, coming up next on the show, I was just at the largest cardiovascular show in the U.S., TCT, and I talked to the pioneer of excimer laser technology. You're familiar with the excimer laser because it's used for LASIK surgery, because it's non-thermal, and it turns the tissue into its own constituent components, so there's no debris in your eye. Well, Frank Litvak, he was at the forefront of bringing this technology to cardiovascular health and unclogging arteries, and he's excited about how far this technology has come since the 90s. Hear about that in my interview with him from the TCT show next.
Now, back to Kim McNicholas on Innovation.
Welcome back to the show. We are with Dr. Frank Litvak. He is very, very famous in the healthcare space. He has a hedge fund. He would never say this himself, but I would consider him the father of laser atherectomy. And for people who are not familiar with atherectomy, I think that they need to be familiar with it. And can you explain why?
Well, with atherectomy in general is the removal of atherosclerotic plaque from blood vessels. Laser atherectomy or excimer laser atherectomy was something that we actually did the original research on back in the mid-1980s and developed and commercialized the first catheters for removing atherosclerotic plaque from blood vessels using the excimer laser. And it has persisted to this day. It actually is thriving now 30 years later. The principle of how the excimer laser works is that it's a 308 nanometer, or a relatively short wavelength for the type of lasers that are used in medicine. And there's enough energy in each photon or each ball of laser light, so to speak, that you can actually break the bonds that hold molecules together and get tissue ablated in what's called in an optical manner. Now, there's always a little bit of a mechanical effect from the catheters as well, but as opposed to any of the mechanical atherectomy systems, the excimer laser is the only one that can ablate plaque using light.
Basically turning the plaque into its own constituent components, the proteins, the lipids, the water, everything that's already in the bloodstream, so that these particles don't go downstream and cause other blockages elsewhere.
Yes, exactly, Kim. The ablation of the material occurs in minute fractions at a time. So you're not coming in and chunking off pieces that are going to float away. In essence, you can't even see the components of what happens after you ablate atherosclerotic plaque.
Why has it taken so long for the laser technology to get to where it is today?
Well, I think the laser technology is, you know, been growing steadily. When we first developed it back in the 80s, we began to use it in the legs. And then we adapted it to the coronary arteries. Where it found its home up until very recently was in the legs. In the coronaries, it largely got supplanted by a variety of other products and technologies that were more effective, actually, at that time, specifically stents. Stents really were a game changer. In the legs, the nature of the blockages in legs are very different than the nature of the blockages in coronary arteries. And the excimer laser has maintained a position in the legs, in what we call peripheral vascular intervention, for the last 25 to 30 years and has continued to grow. And I think now people are beginning to look at it in a few other areas. They're beginning to look at it for an area of the legs that's very problematic, which is the area below the knee, which is an area where diabetics really get into trouble and unfortunately on occasion can lead to amputation. And now it's starting to be looked at again for very specific applications in the coronary, specifically the ability to create a channel in a totally blocked coronary so you can then put a stent down and open it up.
So was it that Spectranetics, they brought their product to market, and now there's a new entrant into the industry. It's Ra Medical. Can you talk about the differences between the two and what the Dabra catheter, which is made by Ra Medical, could bring to the table?
So let me just go back and give you a little bit of the history. Spectranetics was not the first excimer laser company. The first laser company was the company we founded in 1985 called Advanced Interventional Systems. We were the leaders and the pioneers in excimer laser for both peripheral and coronary. Spectranetics and Advanced Interventional Systems merged in a 49-51% merger in the early 90s, and the name Spectranetics got carried forward. But almost all of what was good, what's functional in Spectranetics, was actually developed by AS and copied later on or given to Spectranetics as part of the merger. So Spectranetics has become the dominant player. Ra Medical is actually very intriguing to me, because they are taking a different approach. What we did at AIS and what Spectranetics is still doing is we developed the fiber optic waveguides, and we created multi-fiber catheters where there's like, think about lots of little noodles going into a bundle to transmit the light from the machine outside the body to the tip inside the body. What Ra is doing with their vascular product, which I think is super interesting, is they're actually using a liquid, not glass, to transmit the light from outside the body to the tip of the catheter. The potential advantage of that is that you're not limited by the inherent inflexibility of glass fibers, and because you don't have the so-called dead space, the space in between the fibers, you actually can get a more continuous beam of light or energy to ablate without these, you know, dark spots or blank spots, which reduce the efficiency of cutting. So that's why I think what Ra is doing is very differentiated.
And overall, an atherectomy here in the U.S., why is it becoming so popular?
Atherectomy is popular because we finally are beginning to realize the advances in peripheral vascular intervention, legs, that we've been, you know, looking at and working on for many, many years. And it turns out that the types of blockages that you see in the legs are not really amenable to straight balloon angioplasty or traditional stenting. They need, in many cases, to have a total occlusion opened with at least a channel so you can get balloons in to open it up. And they also need, in many, if not most cases, the ability to remove some of the material to so-called atherectomize the material. So laser is one of the methods that's being used.
And one more question. Why is it that the U.S. is really progressive with atherectomy and Europe is really resistant to atherectomy and is more prone to using simply balloon angioplasty?
That's a very complex question, and probably we could spend a half an hour talking about that. But there are practice pattern differences in the U.S. and Europe and also in Asia. And each of those geographic areas tends to have its own method of getting things done. In general, in Europe, there's a lot of cost consciousness. So the application of new technologies are used with great scrutiny and very carefully, often to the point of not using them when they might be helpful, because there's so much cost consciousness depending on the country. And part of it is also cultural, just different practice patterns.
Thank you so much, Frank. Really appreciate it. And that is the show for the day. Have a great weekend, everybody.
This has been Kim McNicholas on Innovation. Find a podcast of the program at kdow.biz. And you can connect with Kim on Facebook/Kim McNicholas or email kimmcnicholas@gmail.com. Be sure to join us again next Friday at 1 for Kim McNicholas on Innovation, right here on AM 1220 KDOW.
Three-star general Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.